Do you have any thoughts about how to evidence neglect for disabled children, particularly those who don't use verbal language?
That's a really good question. And what I always say is talk to the people who have the expertise in that field. I don't have expertise in that field. And I would say for any of you who are working where you've got a child with a disability, talk to the people who know that child best. Talk to people who have expertise in that field, just as the same with attachment. You know what? If there's an area that we don't know enough about, get the evidence from the people who do know. That's what I'd say.
Okay. Thanks, Joanna. Next question. What about evidencing neglect for an unborn baby? When it is the parent's first child and there is no substance misuse?
Yeah, that's an interesting one too, because when we go to court, obviously you can't go to court until the baby's born, but then you can use, if you're talking about, I mean, generally we're looking at domestic abuse then, aren't we, the impact on the unborn baby. In this country, we wouldn't talk, you know, so we'd be looking primarily at domestic abuse. There is so much evidence now about the impact on the unborn baby. Use that evidence. Use the research. There's a huge amount out there. Again, you'll get slightly differing views from the academics, but it's generally accepted that the cortisol will cross the placenta and have a very significant impact on the developing brain of the baby. So use the research.
Okay, thanks, Joanna. Got another question here with a sort of little, clearly from someone's experience. A senior police officer working in child protection told me they never pursue neglect cases because they are, in quotes, impossible to prosecute. Is one of the barriers a lack of professional support and apathy?
I wouldn't say it is. It's not, certainly not in my experience, because that's talking about neglect in the criminal court, which is a different, it's obviously a much higher threshold and it's a different definition. I can only really speak from my experience and what I've seen in 20 years of practice and doing serious cases and working all over the country. I've never seen that, because ultimately it's the local authority that goes to the court. So, you know, we're the ones that have to present the evidence to court. I haven't come across that myself.
Okay, thanks. Next question. If home conditions are disgusting and squalid, is it appropriate to say words like filthy and dirty in a court report?
And we've just had the word appropriate as well. I think what you've got to do, and it's fine using appropriate in that context, but I think what you've got to do, I wouldn't use those words that sound very pejorative. I would be very clear. We had a big discussion once about how we were going to describe to the court that somebody was very, very smelly and very dirty. And so the sentence that we came up with was that he had an odour, but a very strong odour that one would normally associate with poor personal hygiene, which is slightly wordy. But I think you've got to be careful. You don't want it to be pejorative, I would say. But you need to spell it out, absolutely. I would say something like, that there was an extremely pungent smell in the kitchen, and there was cat feces on the floor that had mold growing on it and therefore had clearly been there for a very long time. And the windows were sealed and it was a very small room. You know, I'd spell it out, but I wouldn't use words like disgusting and filthy.
Okay. And would you include concerns in your list of never used words too?
I mean, spell it out. I'd say if you use... Yeah, I mean, again, what does it mean? I think that we've got to get away from all these words, because what they do is they're sort of blanket words, and we need to get rid of them all and just tell it how it is and explain what's happening.
Great, thank you. Next question. Do you not think that high caseloads are impacting upon, or as you say, hindering the judgment on neglect cases, given the fear around the judgments associated with values? As this requires confident, attuned practitioners with time to reflect.
And there's no doubt that high caseloads impact on how we work. But what I would say is what I said earlier about working superficially. You know, when I'm doing serious case reviews, I see professionals who have gone way beyond what's in their job description. They've worked so hard, but what they often they've never really understood that child's world. They haven't understood things like the parent's capacity to change in terms of the motivation. They've really only scratched the surface. They keep hearing the mother who says, yes, no, I'm definitely going to do that this week. And they believe it. And they're not getting, because we're not getting underneath We don't understand what's happening, and that means we're working with families for a long time. And so that's going to increase our caseloads because we're not really understanding it. If we work much more effectively with neglect, and some, you know, the odds are against us often. The research tells us that the most effective way to work with neglect is a very small number of professionals working very intensely, and yet often that's not how our systems are set up. But I think that the more we, the deeper we go, the more we understand, the more effectively we will work, and therefore that will have an impact on our caseloads.
Great. Thanks, Joanna. Next question. What are the implications for assessing neglect given the introduction of 26 weeks for care proceedings?
Well, I mean, it's going to, you know, of course, that impact on everybody, but I think that it goes back to the same thing, that we have to be very, very clear about why we're in court. We've got to present the evidence. But you see, what I see again and again is that the evidence is there, but very often we're just not presenting it. So, yes, all these things are going to have an impact on the way we work, but if you go back to the child, if everything goes back to the child, it must be right for the child that we do things much more quickly, with neglect cases particularly, because it's those ones that we leave the children in homes for years and years sometimes, and it just does so much damage.
Okay, thanks, Joanna. And this question sort of related to that then. How long is too long to give a family time to change?
Yeah, that's how long's a piece of string. It has to be case by case. It has to be family by family. I think those of you who are familiar with the work of the Family Drug and Alcohol Court, where, and if you're not, then I would suggest looking at it. It's been evaluated all the way through, I think, by Brunel University. They work for very, very tight timescales, and they work extremely effectively. And I think their results are showing pretty positively in terms of the impact on children of the work that they're doing. I can't answer that question because it depends. Every case is different. Every child is different. Every set of circumstances is different. It has to be case by case.
Thanks, Joanna. Next question. Do you think signs of safety is an approach that has improved the response to neglect?
Well, I have to say I don't know enough about signs of safety. It isn't something I've been involved in, so I only know about it vicariously. What I know of it, I like that, but I don't think I'm really qualified to answer that question because I don't know enough about it.
Interesting question here. Somebody's asking, the chronology can clearly evidence resistance and disguised compliance. Would you agree?
Definitely. Definitely. They're brilliant for that. Absolutely brilliant. Because they show you what's actually happening as opposed to what you're being told. And again, what we know from serious case reviews is that so often we cling on to the one positive. You know what it's like when you're working with a family that's chronic neglect, everything's terrible, and you're finding it really hard to find something positive to say, and you don't just want to be all doom and gloom. And so what we do is we focus on the fact that one visit we did, the home actually didn't look quite so bad, there wasn't any cat feces on the floor, and we all cling on to that, and we actually overlook the fact that in the other 12 visits there was cat feces on the floor and you've got a baby crawling around. So we cling on to the positive, and that's what integrated chronologies help with. They really show you what's actually happening.
Okay, thanks, Joanna. Next question. How can we evidence without making reference to expert reports? If we base our judgment on only our observations, will we not be told that we are not experts in that field?
Well, I mean, I think the government is very clear in what they're saying at the moment about social workers being seen as experts, and they're cutting down on the number of experts that they bring into the court. I mean, if another expert opinion is requested by the court, then we go with that. Of course we do. But social workers need to see themselves as experts in the court, and the government is very clear, this government is extremely clear, that social workers are experts in the court. But we have to know what we're talking about, and we have to believe in ourselves that we are experts in our field.
Okay, thanks, Joanna. Got an interesting question here on political correctness. Do you think that political correctness prevents social workers from carrying out their work properly?
I don't know if I would use the term political correctness. What I would say is that I think we're all very, very frightened of getting it wrong, particularly with ethnic differences, racial, cultural. We're very, very frightened. We know that the majority of people who live in this country are white British. I think the last census, it was something like 85%. It'll be less now because that was in 2011. But what we also know is that when you're working with a family from the black and minority ethnic community, if they are abusing their child, some of those families will accuse the workers of being racist because it's a very powerful thing to be accused of. And so we walk away. So I wouldn't necessarily call it political correctness. I would say that we are very worried because most people don't want to be racist. They don't want to be insensitive. They don't want to get it wrong. But you need to be asking questions. You need to question when somebody says it's cultural. You need to think about it. And what we should really do is we should strip away race, skin color, religion, culture, strip it all away. Is it, and ask yourself the question, is it okay for my child? And if it isn't, then it shouldn't be okay for that child. We shouldn't have different bars. We have them. We have them with children with disabilities. We have them with children from the black minority ethnic community. And we shouldn't. Because what we're actually saying by doing that, we're doing the complete opposite. We're saying that child doesn't matter as much because we're not affording that child the same level of protection.
Okay. Thanks, Joanna. Next question. How do you take a case forward if you feel there is one, if other professionals disagree and think that the neglect is minimal?
Well, I would say that you need to be presenting the evidence that you've got that makes you think that to your manager. And if you believe that child, you know, depending on the level of neglect you think is happening, you need to be discussing that with your manager. And if they're not taking it as seriously as you are, I would ask yourself the question, are you presenting the evidence clearly enough? And if you believe you are and the manager's still saying, I don't think this meets the threshold of the court, then you should use whatever version of the escalation policy you have in your local authority and go to the manager above.
Thank you. Next, time for a few more questions. Do you feel that neglect can contribute to child sexual exploitation? And how can we evidence this without being accused of not being an expert in this field?
Sorry, do we think neglect can?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely, undoubtedly. We know there is a very, very strong link between children and young people who are neglected and those children then being sexually exploited, because it's that child who's out and about, nobody cares where they are, nobody knows where they are. It is that child that is so vulnerable because they don't have the social skills that another child has. They don't know how to make normal, healthy friendships, so that makes them much more susceptible. So children, and what I found brilliant was in Operation Bullfinch in Oxford, what they did was they consciously decided not to call the children young people. So they called every single potential victim a child because they are their children, and very often they're children who are living with neglect. And that's why nobody knows, nobody cares where they are. Not always, of course not, but in many cases they are.
Great. Thanks, Joanna. Next question. I find it difficult to engage health professionals in this process. I often feel that autism or ADHD becomes an easier explanation for situations that I would perceive as signs of neglect. How do I overcome this?
I think I would say that you need to be starting much earlier than a diagnosis of autism or ADHD or anything else. That it's difficult to talk about, you know, because it sounds like it's individual cases. But, you know, as social care, you are, as social workers, you are the lead professionals in child protection. If you think this child is at risk of significant harm, then you're the lead professional in that. And we need to work as closely as we can with other agencies. But again, I would always say, are we really presenting what we think is the evidence clearly enough in those discussions with our colleagues from other agencies?
Okay. It's 7:30 by my clock now, but I'll make time for one last question because this is something that might affect quite a few people. So you're being asked, why is it that you favour the findings of Dr. Perry over those of other scientists? I'm not disagreeing with you, it's just for backing up my own reasoning.
Yeah, I'll tell you why I talk about Bruce Perry, because he's hugely influential at the moment. He came over here, and the MP, Graham Allen, who's sort of leading the work in this country, developing strategies, and, you know, government policies and procedures. They have been hugely influenced by Bruce Perry. And so that's why I talk about him, because he's extremely high profile. I certainly added the caveat that there are, you know, not everybody agrees with everything that he's doing. But what he is doing, which is brilliant, is he's raising the profile of the impact of neglect. And that can only be a good thing.